Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.10, Ottoman Bank Takeover, Armenian Resistance, Part 5. Last time, we followed the tragic series of events that led up to the Hamidian massacres of 1894 to 1896. And I gotta say, that was a pretty tough episode, because it's just very tragic history, but it is a very important part of this story. And it does give you a new appreciation for some of the epithets that young Turks like Ahmed Reza, who we'll be introducing next episode, by the way, will throw at Abdulhamid. Because following the Hamidian massacres, Ahmed Reza, as the leader of the Young Turk movement, will use quite colorful language to describe Abdulhamid as a, quote, cheat, hangman, scourge of God, bloody despot, bloody majesty, degenerate tyrant, disgrace of the Muslims, wolf guarding the sheepfold, and Red Sultan. And then the Sultan's own brother-in-law, who we will also be introducing soon, Damad Mahmud Pasha, would say following the massacres, quote, "The whole Ottoman Empire is a prison. The monster of Yildiz has annihilated thousands of human beings, Muslims and Christians." And this is one of those few times in history when the extreme language of the political opposition is kind of warranted. This isn't like the American colonists calling King George the Mad King because of a few new taxes, or even like Russian revolutionaries calling the Tsar Bloody Nicholas. Abdulhamid really was directly responsible for the deaths of thousands of his subjects. And as we'll see, the Hamidian massacres will be a major turning point because many of the Sultan's Muslim subjects will turn against the Red Sultan as a result of this bloody campaign. And this will set the stage for the revolution of 1908 and for the Sultan's eventual overthrow. But we will get to the Muslim opposition and the Young Turks next time, as today we are going to wrap up this first stage of the Armenian resistance. And after today, I am going to take a 3-week break to recalibrate, but when we get back, we'll be diving headlong into the Young Turk movement. But for today, we're going to follow the climactic events in Constantinople surrounding the Ottoman bank takeover. So, in the summer of 1896, as the horrific chaos of the Hamidian massacres was finally beginning to calm somewhat, the Central Dashnak Committee of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation met to discuss how they could possibly bring Western European attention to the terrible sufferings that their people were enduring under the murderous regime of Sultan Abdulhamid. And even though we know in hindsight that 1896 would be the final year of the Hamidian massacres, to the Armenians of the Ottoman Empire, the ongoing threat that violence might suddenly erupt once more was very real. And with this ever-present fear still gripping the Ottoman Empire, many Armenian revolutionaries were now convinced that the Sultan and his reactionary government had as their ultimate goal the complete end of the Armenian presence in Ottoman lands. So, these revolutionaries felt that they had a duty to do everything in their power to save their people from possible extinction. The Hamidian massacres had galvanized many Armenians across the diaspora. One such Armenian was a 24-year-old student of agriculture currently living in Nancy, France, whose given name was Garagin Pastermagian, but who would later come to be better known by his revolutionary nom de guerre, Armin Garo. Armin Garo was born in Erzurum, the capital city of one of those 6 Armenian provinces of eastern Anatolia, a province that sits in the very northeastern edge of Ottoman lands and abuts the Russian Empire. Garo was a product of a westernized Armenian school called the Sanasarian College, and his hometown in Erzurum was, much like the city of Van farther to the south, an early center of revolutionary activity within the Armenian community. In 1890, when Garo was an 18-year-old student, the Ottoman authorities launched a raid into Sanasarian College because it was rumored that weapons were being stored at the school. And even though no weapons were actually found, a small group of reactionaries in the city, now paranoid about Armenian revolutionaries, attacked the Armenian quarter of the city. The Armenians of Erzurum did not take this attack lying down, though, as they did their best to fend off this violent mob. In the ensuing skirmish, a handful of people were killed on both sides, Then later that same day, a group of 200 or so Armenians marched down to the town center to protest this unprovoked attack, and they drew up a petition to be sent to the Sultan. Up to this point, resistance of any kind from the Armenian community was fairly unusual in Erzurum. So the local authorities ordered the group of angry protesters to disperse. But the Armenian demonstrators refused to back down, and in response, an Ottoman battalion was sent into Erzurum to maintain order and to forcibly disperse the crowd. But again, the Armenians refused to back down, and during the subsequent standoff, Armenians in the crowd began to reveal that they were armed, an unusual sight in the Ottoman Empire, where Christians were prohibited from carrying weapons. Over the past few years, revolutionary agents from the Hunchak Party had begun to distribute arms to the local population of Erzurum, as they had done in Sassoon and Van around this same time. So when this Ottoman battalion attacked what had up to this point been a peaceful demonstration, Hunchak agents suddenly revealed themselves, and in order to defend the crowd, they fired upon the Ottoman regiment and killed two soldiers. In response to this incident, the Armenian quarter of Erzurum was sacked, leading to the deaths of 15 Armenians, the wounding of hundreds of civilians, and the widespread looting and pillaging of the Armenian neighborhood. This confrontation in Erzurum occurred just a few weeks before the Kumkapu demonstration in Constantinople that we talked about 2 weeks ago, in which there would be a similar standoff between Ottoman soldiers and Armenian demonstrators who were armed and defended by Hunchak revolutionary agents. So just like the Kumkapu demonstration, the Erzurum incident also represented a coming out party for the Hunchaks in 1890, and both events influenced Sultan Abdulhamid's initial creation of the Hamidiye Regiment that same year. Just a year after the Erzurum riot, Armen Garo would graduate from the Sanasarian College, the school that had been the center of these initial hostilities. Then a few years later, after things had settled back down a bit, Garo would move to France to continue his education. However, Garo had left home in 1894, right on the cusp of the Hamidian massacres. So when he arrived in France, he quickly began to receive news of the terrible atrocities being committed in Sassoon, Constantinople, and eventually in Garo's hometown of Erzurum. So Armen Garo desperately began to seek out ways in which he might be able to help. And it was within this context that he first made contact with the Dashnaks of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation. So let's catch ourselves up a bit on what the Dashnaks have been up to, because most of our attention last episode was on the Hunchaks, as they were much more active in the early years of the 1890s. So if you remember from two episodes back, the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, often called the Dashnaks, meaning the Federation, was originally founded in 1890 in the city of Tiflis by Christopher Mikhailian and his old buddies from People's Will. As we discussed, the Dashnaks had a bit of trouble getting things going early on, in large part because Mikhailian was attempting to put together a very diverse coalition of Armenian nationalists, who ranged from conservative business tycoons in the Caucasus to radical Marxists in Geneva. And this initially slow start is why the Hunchaks, who were those radical Marxists in Geneva, officially broke with the Federation in 1891, just a year after the party had been formed. And well, the Hunchaks had been by far the most well-organized and most effective faction within the new Federation, so the Dashnak Party nearly fell apart as a result of this early split. But Mikhailian did finally get his act together, and in the spring of 1892, he organized the first General Congress of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation. This Congress, held in Tabriz, Persia, really represented the beginning of the Dashnaks as an active revolutionary party, and it was also when the Dashnaks formalized their revolutionary agenda. Adopting a more explicitly socialist ideology, the Dashnaks declared as their aim the establishment of a free Armenia, in which a democratic government would be established under universal suffrage, freedom of the speech and the press would be protected, exploitative and arbitrary taxes would be eliminated and replaced with a progressive tax system in which the wealthy would pay a higher percentage than the poor, and education would be compulsory and universal. And then another more abstract goal centered around the conservation and cultivation of the communal principles already present within Armenian village life. And in this, the influence of the Russian Narodists, those agrarian socialists, really shines through. But instead of putting faith in the idealized Russian peasant, the Dashnaks sought to base their future society on the idealized Armenian peasants and artisans, whom they saw as already possessing the necessary disposition towards communal life that could be built upon to construct a more equitable and just society. Now, even though the two parties had split in 1891, a lot of the Dashnak goals directly mirrored the goals of the Hunchaks, with the biggest ideological difference being that classic division coming out of the Russian Revolutionary Underground. Who should we base our future society around? The peasants or the workers? The Hunchaks were Marxists, so they naturally wanted to base their society around the revolutionary proletariat of the working class. The Dashnaks were more influenced by the Narodists and showed more of an affinity to the peasant and artisan classes. But that being said, the socialist ideologies of both parties did share a very important similarity within their platforms, and that was their uneasy balancing of Armenian nationalism with socialist internationalism. A central aspect of Marxist doctrine is the belief in international class solidarity amongst workers from all nations. This is the classic formulation, workers of the world unite. And then the Dashnaks, for their part, also professed within their party platform a commitment to the national liberation of all peoples, including Turks and Kurds. So, in both of these party platforms, there was an explicit recognition of the fact that the central problem lay with the tyrannous, exploitative, and violent Ottoman imperial system under Sultan Abdulhamid. And so the problem was not the Turks or the Kurds as a people. And it is important to keep in mind that this isn't some dreamy, starry-eyed belief. This directly mirrored reality. Because even though the Hamidian massacres would see an unprecedented level of mass violence, this violence was perpetrated by a very specific group of reactionaries. The majority of Muslims generally tried to shield themselves from this violence. And then those who did participate in the violence were usually in some way or other themselves in a desperate situation, whether they be Kurdish nomads or Circassian refugees suffering within the harsh environment of eastern Anatolia, or poor Muslim workers living in squalor in Constantinople. As international socialists, both the Hunchaks and the Dashnaks recognized this reality and made it a central part of their party platforms. So at their initial party congress in 1892, the Dashnaks established a general openness to other nationalist struggles. And this openness of the Dashnaks will be important in the years leading up to and following the Young Turk Revolution. Because one of the most important alliances within the revolutionary coalition will be the alliance between the Turkish nationalists of the Committee of Union and Progress and the Armenian nationalists of the Dashnak Federation. Now, as we are going to see, this will always be an uneasy alliance. But the reason that it will hold for several years is because both parties would at least publicly express a desire to create solidarity between the different nationalist movements of the Ottoman Empire, under certain conditions. And now we come to the critical point. These certain conditions would be, in short, a commitment to maintaining the territorial integrity of the Ottoman Empire. Or in other words, nationalist movements would be supported, or at least tolerated, as long as they were not separatist movements. You can demand reforms as a nationalist group, but you cannot try to break away from the empire in the style of the Balkan Christians. And even at this first party congress of the Dashnaks way back in 1892, there was a certain acceptance of this reality, because at no point in their party program did the Dashnaks ever state a desire to gain independence as an Armenian nation state. The focus was on winning reforms, not separating from the empire. And in the long term, this commitment to the territorial integrity of the Ottoman Empire will be the critical distinction between the Hunchaks and the Dashnaks. As we stated two episodes back, the Hunchaks set as their ultimate goal the establishment of an independent Armenian Socialist Federation, consisting of the three Armenias in the Russian, Ottoman, and Persian empires. The goals of the Dashnaks were much more humble and honestly more realistic. Win reforms within the Ottoman framework. Okay, with all this talk of reform, you might be thinking that the Dashnaks are going to start, like, petitioning the Ottoman government for tax reforms and equitable land distribution. But this is really not the case at all. Because while the Dashnaks may have had more moderate goals, the methods they planned to employ to achieve these goals were definitely not moderate. In their party program, they stated within their list of acceptable tactics, propagandizing amongst the people, organizing guerrilla bands within eastern Anatolia who would defend communities from the abuse and arbitrary violence of Turkish officials and Kurdish bandits, establishing revolutionary committees who would educate peasants and townspeople in revolutionary ideology, provide them with weapons, and then train them in the art of self-defense. And then there was this other vague commitment to subjecting the Ottoman government to looting and destruction, which in practice meant launching raids against military garrisons, executing armed robberies, assassinating notorious public officials, and committing acts of political terrorism. And these revolutionary tactics, which were a real grab bag of, like, basically every tactic available, again put the Dashnaks in line with the Hunchaks, who were similarly open to using any means necessary to achieve liberation for the Armenian people. And so, when the Hamidian massacres really began to spread in 1895, both the Hunchaks and the Dashnaks would send revolutionary agents into eastern Anatolia and organize militias of fedayi to help protect civilians from the terrible violence of the reactionary forces under Abdulhamid. And going into 1896, the Hamidian massacres just kept getting seemingly worse and worse. And even though there would be a slackening in the violence later that year, many revolutionaries felt that if they let up at all in their defensive measures, then Ottoman Armenians would once again be left vulnerable to attack. This was the state of the Armenian revolutionary scene in 1895 when the young Armen Garo joined up with the Dashnaks. Initially, Garo and a few of his friends, the most notable of these friends being a fellow agricultural student named Haig Tiryakian, had at first reached out to the Hunchaks because they had heard about their activities in Zeytun and were inspired by the Hunchaks' heroic defense of the town. But the Hunchaks had brushed Garo and Tiryakian off, and so they then reached out to the editors of the Dashnak newspaper based in Geneva. And after receiving a positive response from the Dashnaks, Garo, Tiryakian, and their comrades would travel to Geneva to receive orders for how they could best help to defend their fellow Armenians. The Dashnaks would send Garo and Tiryakian first to Cyprus and then finally to Constantinople. When Garo reached the Ottoman capital, the Dashnak committees in Constantinople were already in the midst of a heated debate over what action should be taken in response to the Hamidian massacres. The Dashnaks were considering a few different options. They thought about sending an expedition to Zeytun to relieve the Hunchaks and the mountaineer rebels currently under siege there. Then they also considered organizing armed fedayi bands over in Persia that could cross the Ottoman border in order to initiate retaliatory attacks against the Kurdish tribes most responsible for the recent massacres. And then the final option, the one they would eventually land on, was what they described as, quote, an act of revenge in Constantinople. So once the Dashnaks decided that their action would take place in Constantinople, their plans began to revolve around the Imperial Ottoman Bank. Now, there were several reasons why the bank became the most logical target. Over the past three or four decades, the Imperial Ottoman Bank had become one of the clearest symbolic and literal physical representations of European meddling in Ottoman affairs. To make a long story very short, following the Crimean War, when the Ottomans suddenly found themselves in a crazy amount of debt to British and French financiers, the Imperial Ottoman Bank was organized specifically to manage the empire's ballooning debt. and through a fairly convoluted series of negotiations, the bank would come under the control of a European general manager and a board of directors made up entirely of British and French investors. So, even though the bank was centered in Constantinople, Ottoman leaders were only able to participate in an oversight role, and so they had no real executive power over the bank's operations. And then as the public debt got worse and worse, British and French financiers essentially forced Tanzimat leaders to turn control of Ottoman finances over to the bank's managers. So by the mid-1860s, British and French bankers were essentially using the Imperial Ottoman Bank to run all the finances of the Ottoman Empire. Because due to the enormous amount of financial leverage that these European bankers had over Tanzimat leaders, the Ottomans were forced to allow British and French diplomats to act as the empire's official financial representatives abroad. And the bank was also given the right to manage basically the entire Ottoman treasury. And over the coming decades, the Imperial Ottoman Bank would grow to become one of the largest banks in the entire world, with branches all across the Balkans, in North Africa, in the Middle East, and in many of the financial centers of Europe. The bank's primary function would almost always be the financing of infrastructure projects throughout the Ottoman Empire, during the Tanzimat era, and then on into the Hamidian era. As we just mentioned, the central office of the bank was in Constantinople. And specifically, it was located in the Galata district, sometimes also called Pera, which was not only the financial center of the empire, but also the European district of Constantinople, where many foreign nationals lived and where many of the empire's affluent minorities also lived, including Catholics, Jews, Greeks, and of course, Armenians. The Ottoman Bank has, it's still there, a very imposing physical structure, which towers above all of the other buildings in the surrounding Galata neighborhood. And the bank also has the appearance of a giant fortress with huge brick walls and neoclassical Roman columns encircling the building. And this imposing physical structure fittingly matched the bank's own imposing presence in Ottoman politics. So, in very concrete ways, the head office of the Imperial Ottoman Bank in Constantinople was both the symbolic and literal physical manifestation of European imperialists using international finance to meddle in Ottoman affairs. So, when the Dashnaks began thinking about how they might be able to draw the attention of the great powers to the sufferings of their people, the Imperial Ottoman Bank became the obvious target because the British and the French were heavily invested in the bank. I mean, they would surely pay attention if all their money was about to get blown up by a bunch of revolutionary terrorists. The ongoing experience of the Hamidian massacres had given the Armenian revolutionaries a keen awareness of the fact that they were in many ways helpless in facing off against the combined might of the Hamidiye regiments, Kurdish bandits, reactionary mobs, and the Ottoman Imperial Army. Revolutionaries from the Hunchaks, Dashnaks, and Armenikans could help to defend a couple of towns here or there, as was seen at Zeytun and Van. But in dozens of other cities and villages, the revolutionaries were just no match for these reactionary forces. The stark reality was that if they wanted to assure that the violence against Armenian civilians would actually stop, they would have to prompt the great powers to intervene. So, the plan was to take over the bank and to hold 150 European officers hostage. Then, once the bank was seized, a separate mission would be initiated in which Fedayi would launch a raid against an Ottoman military barracks located in one of the Armenian quarters of Constantinople. Finally, the Dashnaks planned to assassinate the Grand Vizier on the Galata Bridge, just down the road from the Ottoman bank. In the end, only the bank seizure would be successfully carried out, because details of these other plans got leaked to the Sultan's secret police. The man chosen to lead the operation to take the Ottoman bank was Papkin Suni, a 22-year-old Armenian from Harput, who had been involved in revolutionary activity since he was a teenager. Papkin Suni had moved to Constantinople with his family as a young boy, and he attended the Getronagan Armenian High School, which over the years has turned out many influential Armenian musicians, poets, artists, writers, and revolutionaries. after serving a short prison sentence for being a rebellious teenager playing with dangerous ideas, Pupkin Soony was enrolled in a naval academy where maybe he would forget some of those dangerous ideas. But alas, Soony immediately began to recruit like-minded youth from the naval academy into a new revolutionary group that he was starting up. Then, once the Dashnaks began to operate in Constantinople, they would fold Soony's little band of teenage rebels into the Armenian Revolutionary Federation. And thereafter, Soony became an important Dashnak agent in Constantinople. During his time working for the Dashnaks, Soony became known for his ability to disguise himself, and he would often dress up like a Turkish peasant in order to gather intelligence on the operations of the Yildiz Intelligence Agency, the Sultan's secret police. So, under the leadership of Pupkin Soony, a small group of about 30 agents disguised themselves as porters and carried large bags allegedly filled with coins down to the Ottoman Imperial Bank. And then a handful of other Dashnaks stationed themselves in the streets surrounding the bank armed with hundreds of bombs that they planned to use to hold off the Ottoman soldiers who would inevitably descend on the building. The revolutionaries made plans to enter the building around midday so that the majority of the bank staff and guards would be off on their lunch break. But even with this careful planning, the actual taking of the bank would end up being pretty haphazard. At 1:15 p.m. on August 26, 1896, two Dashnaks dressed up as businessmen entered the bank and approached two separate counters, each of them asking if they could make a deposit. When the bank clerks agreed, the businessmen signaled to their porters to approach with their bags of silver and gold coins. But then, after one of these porters gave a whistle, the bank was suddenly filled with dozens of armed men and women who opened their bags and revealed that they were not carrying coins but weapons, ammunition, and bombs. The Dashnaks then began firing their weapons wildly into the air as one of them dramatically declared that they were Armenian revolutionaries and they would not harm the clerks as long as they obeyed their orders and as long as their demands were met. But due to the large amount of noise and commotion they had just made by firing their weapons into the air, a handful of the bank's guards who were still on site entered the lobby and began firing upon the Dashnaks, killing three of their members, including the operations leader, Pupkin Soony. After Soony's death, Armin Garo would quickly prove himself to be a natural leader, as he took control of the group and began giving commands to the Dashnak agents. And even though they had now completely lost the element of surprise, under Garo's leadership, the Dashnaks managed to disarm the guards and were able to take control of the bank. A standoff then ensued as Ottoman soldiers began to surround the building, showing the revolutionaries inside that the planned defense of the outer perimeter had clearly failed. Over the next 12 hours, no significant move was made by either side, except for the occasional moments when Ottoman soldiers would just casually fire a couple shots into the bank just to remind the Dashnaks that they were still out there. But during the standoff, the revolutionaries used this dead time to arm bombs all throughout the building, because the threat of destroying the bank was to be their primary bargaining chip. Dashnak negotiators were then dispatched to list out their demands. These negotiators began by declaring that if the soldiers tried to invade the building, the revolutionaries would detonate their bombs, and these explosions would take down the entire building, destroy all of the money inside of the bank, and kill the hostages as well as the revolutionaries themselves. In order to avoid this outcome, the Dashnaks demanded that certain guarantees be made by representatives of the great powers. To begin with, the Hamidian massacres must be brought to an immediate end. The six Armenian provinces should be put under the leadership of a European High Commissioner. A militia and gendarme police force would be established in the six Armenian provinces, and these forces must include Armenians native to these areas, and they must be put under the command of European officers. Armenian political prisoners would be released and political exiles be allowed to return home. Land that had been usurped during the massacres must be restored to their Armenian owners, and the current Armenian patriarch, who was viewed by the Dashnaks as a puppet of the Sultan, needed to be dismissed and replaced with a patriarch more friendly to the people. In response to these demands, the Ottoman representative said, "We'll think about it," and they began the process of arranging for a representative of one of the great powers to act as a mediator. This process took many, many hours, and while the Dashnaks awaited a final response, they could hear and see a reactionary mob forming outside of the bank, as hundreds of people menacingly carrying swords, sticks, and axes began hacking at the door of the bank, trying to force their way in. To defend themselves, Armin Garo ordered that his agents drop bombs onto the mob, and these explosions killed and wounded many in the crowd. The explosions successfully fended off the reactionaries for the time being. Finally, at 1 a.m. the next morning, 12 grueling hours after the Dashnaks had originally taken the bank, a Russian representative named M. Maximov approached the bank and let the revolutionaries know that it was time to talk. Armin Garo would take the lead in these negotiations, and he and Maximov engaged in a tense debate over the next 2 hours. Finally, a settlement acceptable to both parties was agreed upon. Maximov would arrange for a French ship to enter the harbor to give the Dashnaks safe passage out of Constantinople. A promise was made that the massacres would come to an immediate end, and it was agreed that political prisoners would be released and reforms would be implemented. At first, Garo and his fellow Dashnaks thought that they had just somehow pulled it off. They had successfully saved their people from future violence and possible extinction. And when the revolutionaries exited the bank, the Russian Maximov allegedly shook Garo's hand and said, quote, "The coup was masterfully executed." The Dashnaks were then escorted through Constantinople to the nearby harbor, where they climbed aboard a yacht owned by the director of the Ottoman bank, and they were then safely taken to a French ship bound for Marseille. But even though the revolutionaries would make it out of Constantinople unharmed, the Armenian residents of the city were not so lucky. Once the Imperial Ottoman Bank had been secured by the authorities, violent chaos gripped the imperial capital once more. Mobs of reactionaries began attacking the Armenian quarters of the city. For hours and hours, no authorities came to disarm the crowds, and when police and soldiers did finally show up, they actively encouraged the mobs, and many would help to arm the murderous crowd or would even take part in the massacres themselves. This pogrom would last for 48 hours, and in the end, it is estimated that 5,000 to 6,000 defenseless human beings, men, women, children, and the elderly, were indiscriminately killed. Quite revealingly, the violence only came to an end once European ambassadors came together to send a strongly worded note to Sultan Abdul Hamid. And then once the Sultan dispatched an order for the massacres to come to an end, the violence stopped immediately. Once Armin Garo, Haig Teryakian, and their comrades began to get word of this violence, they were bitterly distraught. Their primary aim had been to force the great powers of Europe to bring the Hamidian massacres to an end, and they had been told by the great power representatives that the violence would be stopped. But instead, the bank seizure had initiated 2 days of horrific violence in Constantinople, the last bloody chapter that would finally mark the end of the massacres of 1894 to 1896. Most outside observers at the time, and many historical commentators today, have viewed the Dashnak Bank takeover as an incredibly reckless stunt undertaken by overly idealistic and politically immature neophytes who simply did not grasp the fact that their actions would have consequences. And this is essentially the critique that the Hunchaks would make right after the bank seizure, as they tried to mitigate the fallout after the Dashnak stunt, as public opinion in Europe actually began to sour towards the Armenian cause, with many in polite European society beginning to see Ottoman Armenians as essentially terrorists instead of as helpless and desperate victims. And while there is some truth to these critiques, we have to remember the context. The Dashnaks had launched their raid on the Ottoman bank within an environment of honestly unimaginable violence. They had every reason to believe that this violence would continue indefinitely and that it might end with the extinction of the Armenians in the Ottoman Empire. So they were willing to put their own lives on the line in what was a pretty selfless and courageous, if still naive, effort to save their fellow Armenians, who were now more vulnerable to attack than ever, as the vast majority of survivors in eastern Anatolia had been left homeless and destitute. So, even though the ultimate result of the Ottoman Bank takeover was that the revolutionaries were given safe passage to France, while the Armenians of Constantinople were left to face the reactionary mobs, this was definitely not their intention. Popkin Sunni, Armengaro, Haig Tyriakian, they all went into the operation fully expecting to die, but they felt that their own deaths would be a small price to pay in order to achieve the larger goal of bringing global attention to the sufferings of Ottoman Armenians. And when they departed Constantinople, the Dashnaks sincerely believed that they had succeeded, because Maximov and other great power representatives had given them assurances that their demands would be met and that real change was finally coming. But even though Garo and his comrades had been promised that the great powers would ensure that reforms would be carried out and that political prisoners would be released, none of this would actually happen. Now, the pogrom in Constantinople would be the last major outburst of violence within the Hamidian massacres, but it is impossible to say whether the cessation of violence was brought about as a result of the bank takeover. Because while the massacres did end shortly after the bank seizure, we can never know if this was ultimately due to the fact that the great powers had issued their note to Abdulhamid. Maybe the Sultan and his cronies had already decided to slacken the violence even before the bank takeover. Or maybe they were planning to instigate another wave of massacres, but were then stopped by the great power intervention amidst the Constantinople pogrom. Cause and effect is sometimes pretty hard to trace, especially when you are dealing with historical actors like Abdulhamid and his government, who were always intentionally blurring the facts. And then it should also be pointed out that we as historical onlookers are always affected in our perspective by what ended up actually happening, i.e., the revolutionaries lived, the Armenians of Constantinople suffered. The ultimate outcome inherently colors our understanding of historical events. There is no way around this. But what should not be missed in all of this is the fact that the massacres in Constantinople did stop when the great powers finally came together to issue a strong, jointly written note to the Sultan, and when the Sultan then relented to these demands and ordered that the violence be brought to an end. This very fact allows us to affix much of the ultimate blame for all this on the great powers and on Sultan Abdulhamid and his cronies. The Sultan was an autocratic monarch who absolutely had the power to both instigate widespread violence and to stop widespread violence. He did both of these things during the Hamidian massacres. And the great powers also absolutely had the power to both sit idly by and allow killings to continue in the name of maintaining the diplomatic status quo, and to stop the killings by coming together to demand that the Sultan put an end to all of it. The great powers did both of these things during the Hamidian massacres. Now, violence perpetrated on this scale is always the work of many bad actors, but as an autocratic ruler, Abdulhamid had the power to restrain the worst impulses of the worst types of people in his empire, and instead he chose to fuel these impulses by stoking fear and paranoia amongst the reactionary elements of his empire. And from what I can tell, this was a calculated decision made by the Sultan and his government to stoke widespread fear amongst one section of the population, namely reactionaries, the Hamidiye regiments, and Kurdish bandits, to provoke violence against another section of the population, Armenians and Assyrians, in order to teach the latter a lesson and to brutally subdue the nascent rebelliousness perceived as emerging amongst them. In short, the Sultan was willing to massacre nearly 100,000 of his own subjects, the vast majority of whom were defenseless civilians, in order to prevent the coalescing of a revolutionary movement amongst the Armenians. And when seen in this light, we can understand how the Hamidian massacres were simply the most spectacular and horrific example of a policy that had been employed by the Ottoman government really ever since the Greek Revolution. Because you may remember, Sultan Mahmud II, who was Abdulhamid's self-expressed hero, had ordered the killing of tens of thousands of his Greek-speaking subjects during the massacres in Constantinople, Missolonghi, and most especially on the highland of Chios. Then, of course, the same thing happened during the Bulgarian horrors when, again, Tens of thousands of civilians were killed in Bulgaria in an attempt to subdue rebellious elements within the population. So, with the benefit of hindsight, we can see that the Hamidian massacres were most likely not an attempt to wipe out the entire population of Ottoman Armenians, but instead were an effort to use mass violence against civilians to force the Armenians to submit to the Sultan's will. The Hamidian massacres would be absolutely devastating for the Armenians of the Ottoman Empire, and they would never really recover from this insanely traumatic event. But as we know all too well on this podcast, and as Abdulhamid himself should have learned from the Greek and Bulgarian stories, mass violence of this kind only serves to strengthen the bonds between people and to harden their resolve to continue fighting for their liberation. Because Abdulhamid had now turned this fight into a life or death struggle. And so, in the coming years, the Armenian struggle for national liberation will continue, as revolutionaries like Armen Garo and Fedayi like Andranik Ozanian carry on the fight to once and for all put an end to the tyranny of the Red Sultan. But in the coming years, Armenian revolutionaries will decide that they need to change their approach, as they come to accept that they cannot rely on the great powers to help them. So instead, Armenians, and most especially the Dashnaks, will begin to form alliances with other oppositional elements within the Ottoman Empire itself. And in this way, the Hamidian massacres would be a major turning point, because many, many people, including Muslim elites, were beginning to feel that Sultan Abdulhamid was single-handedly driving the empire into the ground. And it is no coincidence that just a month after the Dashnak Bank seizure, a coup against Abdulhamid would be attempted by a group of dissatisfied army cadets, bureaucrats, religious scholars, and graduates of the professional schools. These young Turks would be foiled in this initial plot to topple Abdulhamid, and all of the conspirators, including hundreds of people only tangentially involved, would be arrested and exiled in the wake of this failed coup. But while in exile, these political emigres would begin, very gradually, to coalesce into a full-blown revolutionary opposition. And even though this opposition was at this point still in its infancy, within a few short years, they will successfully overthrow Abdulhamid. And by now, you probably all know who I am talking about. But before I dramatically say their name, I want to remind you that I am taking a 3-week break over the Thanksgiving holiday. But when we come back, we will meet the revolutionary party who will finally take down the Red Sultan. So join me in 3 weeks as we introduce the Committee of Union and Progress.